Good morning. Again this week, a wave of revelations about the heartbreakingly painful, lonely lives lived by women and children forced into mother and baby homes around the country. Marion Kelly was 18 when she gave birth to her son Anthony in the Bessborough home in County Cork in 1974. And as she told RTE's Pascal Sheehy, her baby boy was taken from her by the Sisters of the Sacred Heart of Jesus and Mary. She believes he was illegally adopted.
From the moment my parents found out, I was put into my bedroom upstairs. We had a public house at the time. I'd be well known in Cork. I was put into that bedroom until I was told that my baby was going to be induced. The labour was horrendous up in St Finbar's. Staff nurses and a top gynaecologist in Cork who induced the child. So a couple of hours after he was born, I was put into the back of an ambulance. They put him into my arms. He was gorgeous. A little dimple on his chin. And they drove me down here in the back of the ambulance with my baby. Drove in there and the back of the ambulance opened, and I thought I was being helped out of the ambulance because I could barely walk, to be honest with you. And Nun put out her arms and took my baby. I turned around and walked away. That was the end of it. I wasn't allowed to see him. I was put upstairs into a bed in a room on my own. Down here, yeah. In a room on my own. I was upstairs, my baby was downstairs. I had one friend, Dora, and I thank her. She was the only one allowed to see me, and my teacher.
Did you ever ask what happened to your baby or if you could see him? Or
I wasn't allowed to see him. He was going for adoption and that was it. And I was told what the eye don't see, the heart don't feel.
And what was said to you in here in Bessborough?
Not a lot. The first paper was signed 2 days later, 2 days after he was born. I have no recollection of that. I actually didn't realise it until I got the forms years later when I came down here. I couldn't believe it. This is a copy of a so-called consent to adoption, all crossed out, dates changed.
What do you believe happened?
It was a forced illegal adoption, without a shadow of a doubt. Destroyed my life. I'm lucky that I know where my child is, and I have contact with him since Christmas again, after 14 years. And I met him a few weeks ago, and he's a lovely guy, and my other children are beautiful, but they've suffered desperately. My life was never the same. They took my child, they took my life.
Marion Kelly with Pascal Sheehy. Sister Sarto, as she then was, began working as a social worker and director of services at that mother and baby home in Bessborough in the early 80s.
Do you think the conditions in Bessborough in the 1980s had changed from what they were in the 1940s, 1950s and maybe even before that?
Oh, yes. Because, as I said, it was a medical model. There was a matron and there were nurses.
And how do you think the women were looked after in the 1980s when you were there? Were they well looked after?
Of course they were. And just to go back to that time, where they said they were, the girls were half-starved, and some of the media spoke about them. But here we had 200 acres of land, which was bought by the congregation. There were five greenhouses in which there were fruit, vegetables. We had a garden over there. How could they be not well fed? But Ireland, as I said, was a poor place. And they came in undernourished. And they were now carrying another human being. And they had to be looked after. They should be. I didn't experience it, but I do know that they would have been looked after.
And the reports that are in the media that they weren't looked after and that their babies were maltreated. I mean, from your experience, what is your response to that? Or from what you were told by those who were there prior to the 1980s when you were there?
Well, there was a farm as well, and they had, up on the farmyard, there was a slaughterhouse where they had their own meat. If somebody said that they were starved, they must have come in undernourished, and they had to be fed.
And a lot of people are calling for an investigation into Bessborough and the other mother and baby homes now. What's your response to those calls?
Let them do it, but why not look after the children of today? What can you do? What can you do about it?
Mm-hmm. I suppose people want to know what the truth is.
Yeah, well, I just don't know. And if there's an investigation, it must be. Let it be.
from Monday's Morning Ireland. On the Today Show, Father Brian D'Arcy spoke of how deeply embedded the relationship between church and state was in those times and the complex and often hypocritical dynamics within the family.
We have arrived at a state now where I think we may really be getting to the heart of this kind of society, the kind of church relationship, the kind of state relationship and the family itself. And I think that it is an opportunity has been given to us now to really look at the kind of hypocritical whited sepulchre view of the country that we had at that time. We do arrive now where we look at society. What kind of family was it that would choose what the neighbours thought about their daughter rather than what they thought of their potential grandchild? I mean, it's horrific to think of that now, that the daughters were put away simply because of what neighbours would say.
And on Liveline, the issues of secrecy and shame were recurring themes. Catherine rang Joe on Wednesday.
I got pregnant when I was 21 and it wasn't accepted at home, so I was told in no uncertain terms that I'd have to have it adopted. So when the time came, I was sent to Dublin on the train with my sister, and my water was broken in I can't remember what station it was now, in the railway station, and we had to rush to the rotunda for me to give birth. Anyway, I subsequently had the baby, and my father actually came to see me, and which I was really, really chuffed. And he stayed for a while with me, and he talked with me, and he just put his hand on the baby, and he said, "God bless you," and he walked out. My mother was the boss. I wasn't allowed to keep it, but I'd say the head would have allowed me to keep it. And I went home after having the baby, and it wasn't talked about. That was it. That was the end of everything. It was as if never happened.
Paddy Keegan was born in Shanross Abbey in Roscrea. He also rang Joe.
I was born in Shanross Abbey, County Tipperary. My mother was admitted in there in 1947, and she gave birth to me in 1948. I was fostered out till I was four. Then I went on to Drogheda. I was moved around a lot, like, you know. And roughly about 8 years ago, it'd be 8-9 years ago, I went down to where my mother was buried, Nemo, and was a sister of hers after being buried. I didn't even know that she was there. And I went over to the priest. He filled me in that there was another man looking for the same family a good many years ago. He told me that if you could find this man, he's a brother of yours. I jumped for joy when I heard it, like, you know, I was so happy to hear that I had a relation, you know, that I could call my own. My daughter put it on the internet when I found out. A friend of his living across the road from in Australia, and he saw the note, and he asked John, did he understand the message? And John understood the message straight away because he knew the address that I put down. We got in touch with each other, and then vice versa. He came over here to Ireland, and I went over to him. I got bad news then. He died only yesterday. I was going to go over for the funeral, but
Paddy Keegan and Joe and the Liveline team actually organised for Paddy to attend his brother's funeral in Australia, which took place yesterday. The calls for a full judicial inquiry into what went on in Tuam and in other mother and baby homes around the country were led by Archbishop Diarmaid Martin on Sunday's This Week programme. On Tuesday, Minister for Children Charlie Flanagan announced the establishment of a commission of investigation with full statutory powers.
The government and the cabinet has decided to establish a commission of investigation with full statutory powers to examine all matters pertaining to mother and baby homes throughout the state.
And the minister said that the inquiry won't get underway until an interdepartmental scoping report has been carried out to establish how the inquiry should be framed. That's likely to be hugely challenging given the culture and belief system at the time and the many issues that have been raised, from the circumstances surrounding the burials, the high mortality rates, allegations of forced illegal adoptions and clinical vaccine trials. Historian Diarmaid Ferreter discussed this on The Gathering yesterday.
we have to look at what evidence is available, and we have to acknowledge that what we have at the moment are fragments, and they're very limited fragments, and they don't justify definitive pronouncements being made, because that can lead to not just distortion and simplification, but also scapegoating. Now, that's not in any way to diminish the gravity of what appears to be at stake here, and this raises so many different questions that you'd imagine it's going to be very difficult to establish terms of reference. What we need now to get beyond fragments is not a belief that we can get a definitive history of the mother and baby homes. That's simply not possible. But we do have to do a trawl of everything that is available so that we can aspire towards as complete a picture as possible. But the question then is going to arise, what is being investigated here? Even the most basic question, how do you define a mother and baby home? The answer to that is not straightforward. And what about all the links between the various institutions? What we do know is that those who are in a position to give testimony really need to have a very important role in all of this. That's been one of the most revealing things of various investigations over the last decade or even more, is the power of personal testimony. But when you begin to make the links between the various institutions, and the fact that Justice for Magdalene laundry women are now saying that they want to, you know, come back into this frame and to look at all of the themes that are linking these various institutions, you really are looking at something enormous. So how you are going to be able to conduct a coherent and well-defined investigation into this, it's going to be very, very difficult, but it has to be attempted.
Historian Dermot Ferriter with Sean O'Rourke yesterday. Well, after all that sadness, Christy Moore was certainly a tonic for the troops when he came into the John Murray studio on Tuesday, full of funny stories from his years on the road and from his childhood growing up in Newbridge in County Kildare.
I've been an ardent fan of Christy since the early days, Chris says, way back before the seminal Prosperous album, and have seen him perform on many, many occasions over the years and in a variety of manifestations and settings. But to see Christy Moore perform among his own people and in his own home place was a unique and truly magical experience. Christy seemed to have gone to school with half the audience and to have either played GAA or music with the other half. You probably added in a few county medals that you don't have, did you, Christy? Yeah?
Well, there's one county medal, only one.
Oh, did you? You won one county medal?
Yeah, I did. And needless to say, I had to bring that up.
Yes. What year was that, Christy?
1959.
I see. For Newbridge?
Under 14, Patrician School, we won the county championship.
Great stuff. And what position did you play in?
Full forward.
I see. And were you on the score sheet that day?
I was. Good. And a lot of women on the sideline maintained I was overage because I was the same size then as I am now.
I see. So you weren't that mobile. You weren't. You were sort of a fella who stuck in the one spot.
I was there to distract the goalkeeper.
And as ever, Christy was more than happy to morph into a human jukebox when listeners rang in their droves with special requests from his repertoire.
Has your routine changed much over the years, Christy? You play music and you prepare yourself for gigs. Is it more orderly now than it was in the past?
Definitely. I would spend an awful lot more time. Like 40 years ago when I was out, I really wouldn't take the guitar out until I was starting. Literally 5 minutes before the gig started. And I wouldn't think about the gig during the day. I would be otherwise occupied with large bottles and tearing around the place. These days, I really spend the whole day doing the gig, thinking about what I might open with, and I like to play for quite a while before I go on. Like this morning, I needed to warm up, to warm the voice up a bit, and I like to be in stillness as well for a good while before I go out.
Now, where do you get that stillness?
I suppose in reflection, and in I have a routine I go through, where maybe a thought process I go through. I think about the people outside who are gathering. I think of the lengths they've gone to get there. I think that there may be somebody out there who's not feeling the best. Is there anything I could do? I reach out to my own little areas of reaching out for to guide me through the night and to give me the strength to do it and to help anyone if I can. Mm. If there's words that could help anybody, maybe I might be inspired to say them.
Would you change, for instance, the songs you sing, depending on how an audience responds? Do you sort of say, oh, this is more of a night for reflective songs than boisterous songs, for instance?
Yeah, completely. I don't work to a set list. I decide what I'm going to start with, maybe the first couple of songs, and after that, it's on the hoof. It's what emerges through the night, and it's the vibe that's in the room, and I see the gig very much as being a collective of the songs, the singer and the audience. It's a three-way situation. Mm. And it seems to work.
It sure does. Here's a song Christy learned from the singing of John Riley, whom he met in Bridie Grehan's pub in Boyle in the early 60s. And it's what my pal Nuala calls the ultimate runaway love song, The Raggle Taggle Gypsy.
There were three old gypsies at our hall door. They came brave and boldly. Others one sang high and the other sang low. And the lady sang the raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. It was upstairs, downstairs the lady went, but on a suit of leather, oh, it was the cry all around her door. She's away with the raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. Oh, she gave to him a glass of wine, she gave to him some brandy, and the fine gold ring that the lady wore, oh, she gave it to the raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. It was late that night, oh, the Lord came in, inquired for his lady, and the servant girl's reply to him was, she's away with the raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. Oh, then he rode east and he rode west, he rode north and south also. But when he came to the wide open field, there he spied his lady, oh. Oh, then why do you leave your house and your land? Why do you leave your money? You're a why do you leave your only wedded lord? All for the raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. Yerra, what do I care for your house or your land? What do I care for your money? For tonight I'll lie in a wide open field in the arms of me raggle-taggle gypsy, oh. Oh, for you rode east when I rode west, you rode high when I rode low. I'd rather have a kiss at the yellow gypsy's lips than all the your gold and your silver, oh.
Christy Moore, who will celebrate his 70th birthday next year, but has no plans to retire, just so long as his voice holds true. That was from John Murray's show on Tuesday. RTE sports anchor Bill O'Herlihy plans to take the long walk to freedom later this month after the World Cup games. He's been on our television screens for almost 50 years and he talked politics and PR, loyalty, heart attacks and cancer and of course soccer with Sean O'Rourke on Wednesday.
Who are you fancying?
Brazil.
Brazil has like buying IBM, you know. Nobody ever gets sacked for buying
IBM. Yeah, but hang
IBM.
On a second. No, that isn't as straightforward as you'd imagine because Brazil are the clear favourites. There's no question of it. They won the Confederations Cup, but bear this in mind. No team that has won the Confederations Cup the following year has won the World Cup. So that's a big negative in that sense, you know. But they scored 80 goals in the course of the last 12 months. They have a good squad of young players. Neymar, who's done poorly for Barcelona, has been lauded as the next big man in Brazil, so we'll have to see how he performs. A hugely important point, no team outside South America has ever won a World Cup in South America.
And people are saying, oh, it's Brazil-Argentina final is likely. But how good are Argentina? Are they relying too much on Messi? You know,
well, Messi didn't do it in South Africa.
Do you think there's any chance that we'll see Giles talking up Ronaldo before this is all over?
As long as he doesn't take off his jersey and throw it into the crowd. I know, in fairness to Giles reckons on Ronaldo as a player, but not necessarily as a person, you know. He thinks he's a fantastic player, but he doesn't like the way he goes on and doesn't like some of the things he does.
And, no, just as a kind of a quirky little thing, I texted my contact in Paddy Powers this morning, looked for odds on whether Dunphy would weep on air in the course of the coverage of this World
Why?
Cup.
Why would he weep on air? He might weep at my departure. Yeah. Well, I tell you this much, he will not, because Darren Maloney is taking over for me. I've watched Darren Maloney, I have an awful lot of regard for him. Darren Maloney, in many respects, is better than I am. There'll be a cultural change, you know, unquestionably. The lads have been working with me for like 1987, I think, Dunphy and I started, or sometime like that. They will find it a big change, but the change will happen and Dara will grow into it and Dara will be, I'll be forgotten in 6 months. I'm telling you.
Maybe a year, Bill.
Maybe a year, but I definitely will be forgotten.
The one and only Bill O'Herlihy. Well, there's been a lot of criticism of the Brazilian government and the shed loads of money spent on infrastructure for the World Cup. But on Thursday, the focus finally shifted to football. The opening game between Brazil and Croatia had lots of drama, the host country eventually beating Croatia 3-1. For Morning Ireland, Angus Cox joined Brazilian fans in Dublin.
Despite the pre-match optimism, things didn't go quite to plan for the host nation early on, with Croatia taking the lead 11 minutes in. Thankfully, though, to the relief of the dominant Brazilian crowd, Neymar began the fight back for the five-time World Cup winners.
when Croatia scored, did you think you were going to win?
We are always very positive about Brazil. We are. We always expect the best.
Yeah. You always believe.
Yes.
Not exactly. Not I've been here for just 24 hours. It's like 2 days ago I was in Brazil. There, we are kind of worried about everything. Of course, we have protests. We do not agree with a lot of things. They had promised us, like, we're going to have roads, subways, and things like that, and didn't come. But we, Brazilians, we know how to make parties, and we are very outgoing. We know how to receive people, and we decided to give a break.
So you've beaten Croatia tonight. Will you win the World Cup?
Yes.
We would like to think so, of course. Like a typical Brazilian. We all do.
Angus Cox reporting there for Morning Ireland. Well, Eamon Dunphy will have a hectic schedule for the next month, analysing the games on RTE with Johnny Giles and Liam Brady and Bill O'Herlihy, of course. He spoke with Des Cahill.
And Eamon Dunphy's tips for the finalists?
I think Argentina and Spain might contest the final, Des. I don't think Brazil are as good as they need to be to withstand the pressure of expectation on them. I think they've had a lot of very dodgy, temperamental players in the side, like David Luiz, for example, Dani Alves, Neymar has had a poor season, and so much is expected of these guys. I'm not sure that they're good enough to handle that kind of pressure.
And on Drive Time with Mary Wilson, Joe O'Connor brought us part one of the non-football fans' guide to the World Cup. Here's an extract from his diary.
Let me say to non-football fans, it's not that your other half prefers a football team to you, although I would hesitate before putting the question in a very direct way. It's just that a football team is better at playing football. You may well be the love of a football fan's life, the most open-hearted, beautiful, intelligent, caring person your darling has ever met, but could you qualify for the World Cup finals? Be honest, you couldn't. Not even if you trained very hard and adopted the flat back four formation. And if you did, you couldn't even beat one of the minor teams, such as Australia, Iran, Algeria or Honduras. Well, okay, maybe Australia. I know many people facing into the World Cup feel their partners are infatuated with football, but that's quite wrong. Okay, they were once infatuated with it, just as they were once infatuated with other aspects of teenage life, such as liking heavy metal music or wearing unwise trousers, or believing that the Labour Party is capable of leading a transformation of Irish society along broadly socialist lines. But over time, that childish infatuation with football has given way to a more mature and grown-up feeling. Yes, love. There is, of course, an important spiritual component. Philosophers have proposed that the central dramatic narrative of football has about it something of the power of great fiction. This is a theory with which many football fans would concur by quietly saying, "What?" So, this World Cup, let's have a celebration of the true meaning of sport, the togetherness of nations, worldwide peace, and the innocent spirit of international friendship. And let's hope England don't win. Only kidding. Sort of.
An extract there from Joe O'Connor's radio diary, heard on Wednesday's Drive Time with Mary Wilson. Well, it's not all about the World Cup in Brazil. 1,500 athletes and 3,000 volunteers from across the country lined out in Limerick for the opening ceremony of the Special Olympics National Games. Aisling Reardon was there for yesterday's Morning Ireland.
I'm Aoife Hegarty. I'm from Rathdonnell. I do swimming. And I also am involved in bowling alley and a swimming club. And I've been practicing out every week. I thought I did very well tonight. Like, you know, the excitement was brilliant. It was very good. Like, you know, when we went out, we sung and we partied.
I'm Bernadette Rooney and my son is in the Eastern Region. He's in the football with Roscourt in Dublin. So it's his first time here. So we're delighted to be here to support him with the family, you know.
Hi, my name is Andrew Murray. I come from Blackrock. I play golf for Special Olympics. Fantastic. Very lovely to be here. Oh, lots of people. I'm amazed. Yeah.
And the best of luck to the athletes this weekend in Limerick. Well, the dark underworld of spies and spooks, electronic sweeps, encrypted messages and surveillance was also a theme this week. On Monday, we had the publication of Judge John Cook's inquiry, and it looks like allegations that the Garda Ombudsman's offices were bugged or that the Garda were responsible were unfounded. A ball of smoke, a point Gavin Jennings put to GSOC's Simon O'Brien.
€18,000 report.
a Garda commissioner gone, a justice minister gone, not necessarily because of this, but it certainly added to the pressure on them. The reputation of the Garda Síochána Síochána damaged, and we find that there was no evidence of bugging. Was it worth it?
We must take reasonable steps to protect our organisation and the data that it has. We did a standard sweep. That gave two credible threats. 18,000 euros to do that, I think, is reasonable. As far as we were concerned, we've never pointed the finger at the Garda Síochána. We've been very clear to say through all this that we didn't have credible evidence that we were under unlawful surveillance. So as far as I was concerned, we've acted properly, professionally, proportionately. It's unfortunate that we find ourselves where we find ourselves.
You say you didn't point the finger at Garda Síochána, but by your very initiation of a public investigation, you were making the Gardaí suspects, or more to the point, you were confirming the suspicion that you believed that the Gardaí were involved. You must have known the damage that was going to cause to their reputation.
Of course, we were minded of the business that we were getting into when we opened the investigation. You will look at what the Act says and how it is, and this is a very low threshold for us to get involved in an investigation under this, that an offence may have been committed and it may have involved a member of the Garda Síochána, or a member of the Garda Síochána may be involved in some form of disciplinary issues. Look, we did that. That was based on reasonable evidence given to us. It formed a reasonable suspicion in our mind to investigate. We investigated proportionally and professionally, and we closed the investigation down. And it seems to me, after 4 months of Judge Cook looking into this again, with the benefit of some hindsight, he comes to very, very similar conclusions. And I think that's why we welcome his report. We very much welcome that we acted in good faith, and I think there is always going to be learning from these things. I'm sure there's learning for us and for many others in this whole business. But we want to now move on and get on with some of the really important work we need to do in the very near future.
Of the three possible breaches of security which were investigated, Judge Cook ruled out two of them, but in one case there were suspicions that an office phone may have been bugged. Acting Garda Commissioner Noreen O'Sullivan said the Cook report had exonerated the Gardaí from any wrongdoing, and Justice Minister Francis Fitzgerald also welcomed the report.
There are issues that arise. There are a number of issues that arise. But I do have confidence in the institution going forward.
Institution.
Yeah, but I'm not commenting on individuals.
Do you have confidence in the individuals who are running GSOC?
Yes, I have confidence in the individuals running GSOC. But there are lessons to be learned, there's work to be done, there's bridge building, and there's cultural change on both sides, in my opinion.
Justice Minister Francis Fitzgerald. Well, I felt I was at the centre of an episode of the hit television series Homeland myself while listening to Glenn Greenwald in conversation with Sean O'Rourke. He's the author of No Place to Hide. It's a book about whistleblower Edward Snowden, the systems administrator on contract to the US National Security Agency, who right under the noses of the NSA downloaded tens of thousands of sensitive documents. The leaked information triggered a massive debate over national security and privacy, but Glenn Greenwald insisted that Edward Snowden's motives were altruistic and that he was clear he would suffer enormous personal cost.
What about his motives for revealing and blowing the whistle? Do you think they're entirely admirable, or might there be an element of him just seeking attention?
Here's why I know they're entirely admirable. Look at the options that he had once he had this archive in his possession. He could have sold these documents to multiple intelligence agencies around the world for tens of millions of dollars and been extremely rich for the rest of his life. He could have passed the information to adversary governments. He could have simply uploaded all the documents to the internet and gotten all the notoriety that he wanted. He did none of those things. He did exactly what you hope a responsible whistleblower does, which is come to journalists and to say, I don't think I'm the one who should make the decision about which of this material should be published and which shouldn't be. I want you to work with your editors and fellow journalists and lawyers and everybody else to vet the material and very carefully report on it. And that's what he did.
And Sean wondered if Glenn had any qualms about leaking the material.
What is the response to the criticism of him and also of you that disseminating and revealing this information and these files, it effectively helps the enemies of the security of the United States? It effectively hands them the playbook of the United States in dealing with them.
It's totally ludicrous. If you look at what the U.S. government says to justify everything that it's done over the last 13 years, from invading and destroying Iraq to torturing people around the world, to kidnapping them and sending them to the worst human rights abusers. They invoke the phrase terrorism over and over and over. It's a fear-mongering tactic used by the U.S. government to put people in fear in the hope that they will submit and acquiesce to whatever power the U.S. government wants to claim. And I think people are now wising up to it. The reality is that over the last year, we have had in our possession tens of thousands of documents. We have published a very small percentage of them because, at our sources' insistence, we have been extremely meticulous and cautious in making decisions about which documents can be safely published and which documents can't be. Terrorists have known for many years that the U.S. government is trying to monitor their communications. Osama bin Laden famously would communicate only by personal courier because he, of course, knew, and al-Qaeda knew, and all terrorists knew, that their emails and telephone calls were being monitored. What people didn't know is that the surveillance system is directed not at al-Qaeda and terrorists, but at them. And the only thing that has been damaged are the reputation and credibility of U.S. officials that have deceived their own population and the world and not American national security.
Glenn Greenwald, heard on the Today Show on Monday. Well, Martin Hayes has made his home in the United States and has campaigned for Barack Obama, but he's best known here and across the world as a virtuoso fiddle player with the band The Gloaming. Martin is originally from East Clare and learned his music from his father, PJ Hayes, leader of the Tullock Haley Band, or the Ayatollah Haley Band, as it was affectionately known. Martin was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday.
Now, tell me about you and Mr. Simon, Paul Simon.
Well, I mean, it's not like we're close buddies, you know, but I know him a little bit, and I played with him a couple of years ago when he came here to Dublin.
How did that come about?
He's a friend of Paul Muldoon's, the poet, you know, who's over in Princeton. And so Paul was over and he was having dinner with Earlo Linard and a few more people. And he invited them to dinner, but didn't tell them they were going to be having dinner with Paul Simon. So they turned up for dinner and Paul right. Simon is sitting across the table and this is great. But in their conversations on music, they must have given me some praise. I think maybe more than I deserve, but whatever way they said it, Paul Simon decided he'd have to have me on his gig. And so I got this call from Paul Simon then, and I'm going, sure, of course I will. Yeah, why wouldn't I do it? And so I just, you know, recorded again there recently for the Seamus Heaney event at the National Concert Hall.
And you came over with him in his jet.
That's right, yeah, that's right. I don't often get to do things like that, but I don't ever get to do things like that. That's what I should say. Yeah, that was nice, you know, but he's a very regular guy. And like what he is completely committed to making music and committed to not dialing it in. I mean, and so he was busy on that plane writing a song and correcting it and revising and revising and revising. He was revising all day. Like, he worked so hard. You know, it was actually, he worked harder than I would work, you know, and he doesn't have to. I have to.
Clown. Kalini mashach bon gelig legal. Oh, hogum refain und sauber.
Martin Hayes, Irla O'Linard and the Gloaming with a song to welcome in the summer, Saura Saura. And Martin Hayes was Marion Finucane's guest last Saturday. On Thursday night, the International Impact Dublin Literary Award, the most valuable literary prize in the world with a pot of €100,000, was awarded to Colombian author Juan Gabriel Vasquez for his novel The Sound of Things Falling. The book explores the drug wars in Colombia and was translated by Anne McLean, and both she and Juan Gabriel spoke with Sean Rocks on Arena.
Well, we get one story in this, or one thing that's mentioned is this Pablo Escobar's zoo.
Yes.
You might tell us what that zoo is, and did you visit it as a child when it was actually in operation? It's not in operation in the book.
Yes, I did. Well, at the end of the 70s, Pablo Escobar acquired this huge property in the Magdalena Valley in Colombia, in which he had many things. He had landing strips for his drug planes. He had his headquarters where he ordered murders or whatever. And at some point, he began spending money in exotic animals. So he had a plane, a Hercules, that he called Noah's Ark, which, you know, you can't make these things up, which flew to Africa to bring hippos and a rhinoceros and zebras and giraffes. And
wasn't there a parrot who could recite all of the members on the football team?
Yes.
And a kangaroo.
And a kangaroo who was very good at shooting penalty kicks, yeah.
Could be useful today, in fact.
Yeah. Well, Colombian goalkeepers used to go there to practice. So it was this larger-than-life place. It was free, open to the public, and it became a touristic destination for my generation growing up as a child. The thing is, our parents didn't like the fact that we were interested in that. It was, after all, owned by a notorious mafioso. So I had to go there on my own, you know, hiding from my parents. And, well, one of the results many years later is this novel, so I guess it was all worth it.
Colombian author Juan Gabriel Vasquez from Thursday night's Arena. Over the past few weeks, we've seen the fallout from our failure to deal with the past. But as Brian Lally in his report from Ballymun discovered, good, decent, committed people are doing positive things in their community. Parents, speech therapists and public health nurses, along with the Young Ballymun Agency, have combined to provide services in the area, and they've just won the Primary Care Centre of the Year award. Brian visited the Access Arts Centre and spoke with Natasha Cahill, a mother of three, and to Sheila Jones, a public health nurse, about their scheme.
Station B is where the public health nurse is in this room. They do weight, height, they talk about weaning, nutrition, appropriate information to that age of the baby. They also plot the child in the centile chart appropriately so that the growth is tracked for the next 3 months to 18 months. So, and you're tracking it all the way along so the parents can see very visually what the growth of the child is, and it's very easy for them to understand. And you give them appropriate advice, be it on feeding, hygiene, could be oral hygiene, whatever is appropriate for the child. The next room they go into is room C, and again that's supported by the public health nurse services. And in that room, it's very specific, and we use a Giselle system of analysing the child's development. And it's divided into five stages of development, which are first adaptive, gross motor, fine motor, language and personal social. Just following that, we ask one parent to stay in the room, and we leave the room, and we do a little video clip of the mother, could be mother or father, interacting with the child, and this is recorded.
Kind of super nanny vibe.
Well, yeah, kind of, yeah. And we record them for 3 to 5 minutes of an interaction with the child. And then at the end of the... this particular video is sent and is coded and see how appropriate the interaction is. And then when they come back to a following point, we give them feedback on that particular interaction.
They're meant to be doing so many things, and they have like a checklist of what they go through.
Similar stuff with the parents as well, I think.
Yeah, they
just
sit
you guys down and give you an MOT.
They talk through, yes, an MOT to see how you're coping with different things. And yeah, because you know how to deal with situations that may arise and stuff like that.
Brian Lally reporting for Drive Time. Well, listening to Countrywide last Saturday, it was obvious the spirit of neighbourliness is alive and well in rural Ireland. Rosie O'Gara, a physiotherapist with the Donegal Football Club, was on her way back from a match near Spittal, and she told Damien O'Reilly exactly what happened when team members spotted a lone turf cutter and stopped the team bus beside the Connemara bog, and how the old tradition of the mehel kicked in.
There would have been about 26 of us all together.
And had he much turf to foot?
He probably had a good, I would imagine, about half the size of your regular football field, and he had just started up the top himself. I'd say he'd probably a couple of hours' work done himself, but he was standing there on his own now, and it is long labour, you know. None of us actually took a second thought about how big a deal it was. We just thought we were going in to help this guy, and, you know, we'll do a good turn and we'll get back in the bus and then we'll just go back to our digs.
Was it rewarded back in the on the field in the competition?
I'm afraid not the next day, but maybe some other day our good intentions will come back to reward us. Maybe it's nice to see that nice things can happen nowadays without any monetary awards or people looking for attention. That we really were just a gang of people that got off a bus, helped a guy out.
From Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly last Saturday. On the business, the chairman of Target McConnell Advertising, Gary Brown, joined Richard Curran and serial entrepreneur Jerry Kennelly to describe what he calls a cult of entrepreneurship amongst young business people.
So what are these guys, what kind of people are you talking about? Are they very young? Are they a bit naive? Are they spoofers?
I think all three in some cases, and obviously there are some genuine ones, but I think if you look at how I would describe some of them, you know, they blag a ticket for 3 days to the Web Summit. They dress like someone from Mumford & Sons. They sit in a beanbag, and that makes them an entrepreneur. Well, I'm sorry, it doesn't, you know.
Well, either Gary has lost his marbles or I have. To be honest, I think entrepreneurship is really important for the future of this country, and nurturing a situation where young people can feel that they can start a business is really, really important. I've spent many years working on this. I started a programme with others called the Junior Entrepreneur Programme, and this year alone, 5,000 11 and 12-year-olds have started classroom businesses. They want to follow their dreams, never give up, and with hard work, anything is possible.
But Jerry,
that's the sort of spirit that's really important for this country, because if you create one job for yourself, Richard, if you create a job for yourself, then you're really adding to the value of the country. And to be honest, there's spoofers in every business, and they get found out pretty quickly, and there's no place like entrepreneurship to learn the lessons of humility very fast.
I think everyone should be given a chance. Of course they should, Jerry. I'm not arguing with that, and I'm all for encouraging young people. You know, but you know, being a Kerry man, there's the old Shanachie. There was a time in Ireland long ago when you couldn't throw a stone, but you hit a high king. Mm. Well, I think we're in danger of you couldn't throw a stone, but you hit an entrepreneur. And, you know, I think there's a problem with this. I'm going to come back to the word business, Jerry. You're a businessman. You know, when you started off, you didn't call yourself an entrepreneur. You became a businessman first. And you developed your business and you had good practical application. Now, what I'm saying to you is that some of these people don't have the business acumen, but they think they do, and they call themselves an entrepreneur based on the fact that they have never set up a business. This is my problem.
Jerry Kennelly and Gary Brown with Richard Curran. Well, stay tuned for Richard. He'll be here shortly, just after the 10 o'clock news with The Business. But I'll leave you now with the song from David Gray, who played live for Miriam O'Callaghan on Sunday with Miriam. Gramahagavasur Golluder, Tasulam Gurwanshiv Salta Saglar, Agus Gameshivlam, Amandakasha, and Tachtan Shahugin, Gajishin, Gajeshib Slan.
My worn out shoes. Quite why she went, I can't decide. But I sure could use one plate of food, steaming and hot, clean linen iron, on a fresh made bed. But I ain't got one salty dime, one salty dime. Just close your eyes, it won't take long, won't hurt a bit. telling myself I could be strong. Some such brave bullshit. Trucks are roaring by, I'm a red ghost in the tail light gleam. I'm a tumbleweed, I'm a spit rose turning in your flame. Oh, my darling Kathleen, na 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 na.